Okay, so this part of the talk is work in progress. So if there are questions which are either positive or negative, please make your comments known, because certainly it could be very helpful for me, your comments. So you want to reproduce this kind of structure, and the first thing one wants to do is to construct the beagle. So maybe so the obvious place to start is okay, G plus is lambda alpha d alpha, and now G minus. So you want this to have the property that G plus with G minus, at least if I take the integral, let's say, around G minus, it should give me T. So we have something which almost does that, which is this B alpha. But instead of giving you T, it gives you T lambda alpha. So what one can do is one can define a lambda bar alpha, which has the property that lambda alpha. So this is something strange, at least for me, where you have quantities which I don't mind having things which are zero, but things which are one are a little bit strange. but there might be some. So this means that lambda and lambda bar, oh, and I also want this, they are both pure spins. So if I'm in SO10 Euclidean space, I can really think of lambda bar as being the complex conjugate of lambda, which satisfies this identity. So that's natural. For various reasons. So, for example, many people have commented that in 10 dimensions, pure spinner has to be complex. So, where is its complex conjugate? So, in some sense, one can think of lambda bar alpha as playing that role as the complex conjugate. Now, this is only in Euclidean space because it has to have the opposite chirality. These constraints here mean that lambda and lambda bar parameterize instead of. So, lambda parameterizes the holomorphic part. So this is a complex space. And lambda parameterizes, if you like, the holomorphic part of this.
It's not. Lambda parameterizes a co-owner of that space.
Okay.
If you divide it by your overall scaling, you
that's right. I'm sorry. That's right. So the projective part of lambda.
Space only 10 dimensions?
Yeah, that's right. I said it wrong. So the projective part of lambda parameterizes. So lambda and lambda bar together parameterize SO10 over SU5. So there are 21 components of this in lambda and lambda bar. So lambda has 11 complex components, but because of this constraint, instead of getting 22, you get 21. Okay, so this is somewhat natural, this coset space. But unfortunately, this doesn't work for the reason that if you take G minus with G minus, so this does satisfy this, just because of lambda bar with lambda gives you 1. But G minus with G minus is not 0. It turns out to be so one would like it to be 0. It has a term which is proportional to G minus, which may not be so bad, but it also has a term which is proportional to H. So when lambda bar is constant, this doesn't contribute. But when lambda bar is non-constant, it starts involving H, where H is defined here. And H, it's just the anti-symmetric part of H. So that's important. Well, this has a 3-form and a 1-form part. The 1-form part doesn't contribute just because lambda bar gamma d lambda bar is 0.
Dumb question. So lambda bar, it looks like lambda bar is sort of conjugate to lambda, also canonically conjugate. You already had the omegas.
Yeah. So, okay, so this is a question that I don't know how. So in this description that I will talk about, there's some indications that one should try to interpret d lambda bar as being the conjugate to lambda. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to do that. Edward has a paper in which there actually is a relationship to this type of second order description. So it would be natural to have an action of the type d lambda bar, if you like to think about it. Second order. Instead, so the action I will use is lambda W D bar lambda. The first order action.
Well, the relation is very simple. You start with that first point and add some fermions. I can call them sine A, the sine DA.
Yes.
So if I assume that in your second action lambda is right wing,
yes,
there's a supersymmetry for left wing. And if I take one of the charges, the square zero, I call it the super DRC charge.
Right.
The DRC charge is generated by lambda and d lambda 1.
Yeah, so you have something like psi d bar lambda would be your DRC operator.
Yes,
something.
You erase the action we were trying to take.
So here's my action. Oh, okay, so I'm...
You want to really...
Okay, let me erase something.
I don't think it's like you call it. We're trying to eliminate the stuff which is. We're trying to reduce the stuff which is homomorphic, so we need to eliminate the anti-homomorphic stuff.
Okay.
So the cohomology of Q kills all the anti-homomorphic stuff.
Don't you want D bar lambda? You want to kill D bar lambda.
Okay, what's the action we're heading for? What is the action?
The action I want is W D bar lambda.
So, therefore, we want to kill those that have a
digit
that have
an energy. Okay, so T is WD lambda.
I know, but your theory was homework, but the one whose action S is not homework. It has anti-homework variables.
Right.
So we want to set some each anti-homework variables are irrelevant. So we introduce a VRST operator with anti-homework variables.
Right.
Which I believe is Q, the way you've written it, is invalid since it's not locked. It is confusing.
I'm sorry, eta. So eta, I guess it's more natural to think of the eta here.
You didn't tell us about it.
I know, yes, I know.
There's something like that. So if you take that action S,
yes,
with a Q, which is a lot like what you wrote,
yes,
then the Q invariant, an important thing is that the Q invariant thing is actually a chiral algebra. And the chiral algebra is generated by lambda and D bar, lambda bar.
Yes.
And the algebra generated by lambda and D bar, lambda bar, is exactly the same as the algebra generated by W and lambda in the other description. So, what is the algebra generated by W and lambda? W of Z with lambda of Z prime is 1 over Z, 1 is Z prime.
That's right.
And in this here with the action S, lambda and
D lambda bar.
Sorry, it's D lambda bar, not that lambda. Lambda and D lambda bar are the same thing.
Yes. So, okay, the puzzle for me, okay, I think I already told this yesterday to you. The puzzle to me is that Q, so one would like Q to be holomorphic. I don't...
Well, we shouldn't call the two things fucking Q.
Okay.
One is not called Q.
Yeah, yeah.
Holomorphic
bottom
Q prime. But that one bottom isn't the full Q prime, because you should have the ordinary VRST operator of the left-wing part of the string.
Okay.
And holomorphic should just mean the Q commits with Q prime. That should be good enough. Anti-commits with us. So, in physical string theory, we've got a VRST operator of left movers and one of right movers and an anti-commit. And anti-commuting with left moving multiply means that right moving dies holomorphic and vice versa. Or I believe it's as much of holomorphic as you need. So I would hope you'd end up just bringing the Q and Q prime.
I see. Okay, so maybe that's some. Okay, so to answer your question, I don't have an answer, but maybe Edward does.
I don't know if it's useful for your project.
Okay, I think it would be. So it's just...
Yeah.
Okay, so... So in my description, everything is all first order. So although I'm using the notation bar, it does not mean right moving on the world sheet. So all of these will be, these are all left moving variables, and type 2 would have the partner.
But you don't like lambda bar differentiated lambda.
No. So I have this relation, but that's... Okay, so one needs to add other stuff to this. And the other stuff will obviously have to involve H because of this. So now I'm going to just write down the answer, and then I'll try to say what are the things that I understand and don't understand about this answer. Okay, so I need a little more space. So just to remind you, K was ND, and L was N. So they said... Okay, so what happens is this B alpha becomes... so there's one other reason that this description is bad, is that I added 10 new variables here. So I added the 10 extra variables to lambda bar, but I didn't add 10 extra fermions. So it's clear that if I want to, for example, keep the partition function being 1, so I didn't mention this, but the partition function is 1 in this formalism just because I have an equal number of bosons and fermions of each conformal weight. So I only have fields here of conformal weight 0 or 1. So I will introduce 10 new fermions which have conformal weight 0, 1, whose contribution will cancel the contribution of lambda. So they, of course, look very much like the zeta and xi. So let me say, so 10 fermions is not the usual number in 10 dimensions. So they are also going to be constrained. So the constraints will be, I will introduce an R alpha S alpha. So they have the opposite chirality from the theta. So this is dimension 1. This is dimension 0 and this is dimension 1. And I want to have 10 independent R's. So the way I will do that in a covariant way is I will constrain these combinations to be 0. So in addition to the constraints on lambda and lambda bar, R will also be a constrained fermion. And I can easily show that this kills one component and this kills five components of R. So you just have 10 components which have the same transformations under the SU5 as the independent components of lambda bar. Okay, now these are the constraints. Now these, of course, are going to generate a whole bunch of gauge invariances. These are fermions.
So how many components
are there? So R has 10 independent components. So this kills, although it looks like it kills 10 components, because this is a pure spinner, 5 of them are depend on the other 5. So it plays the role of the, if you like, the non-minimal partner of the extra lambda bars that I added. So these are the constraints on the dimension 0 world sheet fields, and then you get the gauge invariances on their conjugates. So the gauge invariances are, it's obvious to read off, but maybe it's convenient to write down. So we have a conjugate to lambda, a conjugate to lambda bar, and we also have the conjugate to R. So these have the gauge invariances that I described before, which are so these just are generated by these constraints. Then you get the gauge invariance generated by this constraint. Let me just call it epsilon. And finally, you get gauge invariances generated by these. So let me call it, phi. Generated by this one, you get a phi r alpha. Sorry, I wrote it down. That's right. That's right. Thanks. And then here you get gamma m. Okay, so those are the gauge invariants. And my constraints here had better be invariant under those gauge transformations.
The epsilon gauge transformation, because you have a 1, means that's only really the derivative of W that's gauge invariant. I mean, you only get gauge invariants in derivatives.
What do you mean?
Because you have a 1. Since the constraint is 1 instead of 0,
yes,
that's going to change.
Well, let me write it like this. I don't understand. What does it change? I just commute this with the variable.
What I mean is the lambda alpha W alpha.
Yes.
Is gauge invariant. Okay, don't forget. I guess you have some signs.
But. Yeah, okay, the signs I'm not sure. Okay, so what I'm going to add here is some kind of non-minimal coupling, which would be which is going to allow me to construct this n equals 2. So I need to introduce these extra 10 fermions also to make this g minus work out well. So let me tell you how this works here. And then there's an additional piece one has to add, which is a bit strange, which I can write it as Q. This was necessary because the piece with G minus not only had a piece coming from H, but it also had a piece lambda by d theta times G minus. Okay. Now the final thing I have to tell you is, which is J. So the obvious thing to write down is lambda alpha. Well, that would naively give you G plus and G minus of U1 charge plus 1 and minus 1. But that turns out to be not sufficient. There's an additional term you have to add, which is which involves lambda and lambda bar. Now, this term would be a natural U1 constraint if I was using the second order form. And this is natural if I'm using the first order form, but somehow I need to have them both. And there's no field redefinition which is going to get rid of this. Just because one way to see that is if you compute J with J, there's a contribution of the double pole of this with this. There's a contribution of the double pole of this with this. Because what happens is the W bar, or the W here, can have a double pole with the D lambda, which gives you something proportional to lambda lambda bar, which is 1. So there's a contribution of the double pole of this with this and this with this. This with this has no double pole. So so the J with J double pole depends on the coefficient of here.
There seems to be an IE field redefinition. What prevents you from shifting W bar alpha to absorb the D lambda term?
Well, if you want the W bar to be independent of W, so you want to do W bar with lambda. But that's going to now mean that it has a pole with W, so you have to shift W and then it's going to come back at you. Now if you didn't the J with T is just the conventional T. So T is just the same as before. So 1 half dx dx plus T d theta plus RDS or SDR I'm calling it.
J is a ghost number.
Yes.
So how do you assign the ghost? Is there
a that's right. So G plus has ghost number plus 1 and G minus has ghost number minus.
No, but for the field.
So lambda has Gauss number 1.
Right,
so lambda bar has minus 1. But things like W don't have well-defined Gauss number because of this. So they're not eigenvalues of J. So you need to add the second term for various reasons. If you didn't add it, you wouldn't get an N equals 2. Because if you compute the J with TOPE, you find, if you remember from the counting I had before, there was something already which was a little bit strange, which was J ghost with T was minus 8, had a term minus 8. And J with J had minus 4. And normally, if one wants to associate this with N equals 2, and this is the U1 charge, these are supposed to be the same coefficient. So what happens is that one has to add this term here to the J ghost in order to get something which forms an N equals 2. Now, I would like, of course, one can also generate this just by trying to close the G plus and G minus. And what you find is, because normally you would not have terms of this type if lambda bar had Gauss number. Because this naively has a double pole with J. So normally when one has terms of this type in G plus or G minus, it's the field without derivatives which has Gauss number. But somehow that's not what happens here. And the reason why it's not what happens is somehow related to this lambda bar equals 1 condition. And I don't have I'm sure there's a nice way to understand it, but I certainly don't have a nice way to understand it. So this is just the N equals 2 you get. And it seems to be important that if you have fields which satisfy lambda bar equals 1, that it happens in this way. But I don't have a nicer explanation. Okay, what this means... Okay, one can compute C hat, and it turns out C hat is equal to 2. So again, if one didn't have this term, we would not have C hat equals 2. So this is actually a critical N equals 2 string. But in order to construct the N equals 4, I would need to have this operator here, which was e to the... So the N equals 4 algebra you usually get from C hat equals 2 by constructing these SU2 currents. So when C hat equals 2, these are dimension 1 operators. But in this case, these are non-local operators, just because if I just had... Well, if I could somehow bosonize this, then I could somehow realize these as local operators. But in this language, at least, I don't know how to realize these as local operators. So again, if I had the second order way of understanding this J using second order actions for lambda, maybe that would turn these into local operators. But I don't know how to do that. So C hat equals 2 is actually easy to understand from this thing I just erased, which is J with T goes like minus 8 in the pure spinor form. And what I've added is 10 bosons and 10 fermions, which just add a plus 10 here. So the C hat equals 2 is actually not hard to understand. Okay, so now what do I do with this? Well, okay, so the first thing you want to do is compute scattering amplitudes. And the hope is that with this N equals 2, at least I'm much closer to the INS description. Okay, before I go to amplitudes, are there questions about this? So it has a mysterious structure, which I hope eventually will be understood. But.
So the new object is G minus?
Yes.
Constructed from lambda bar and from that mysterious B?
So these are, that's right. So, that's right.
Can you give us a quick recapitulation of how you got found G minus?
Yeah. Okay, so, the B, H, K, and L, that is more or less, so I found these objects just by asking, essentially solving cohomologies for the, so Q with B was lambda alpha T, Q with H.
Q is G plus.
I'm sorry?
Q is the same as G plus?
Without this term. this was equal to lambda alpha b beta, etc. So with k was is equal to h and l. And this, these are all anti-symmetrized here. I should have said. Okay, so now if I compute the OPE of B with B, you find a term that goes like H, or actually lambda bar B with lambda bar B is better. You get a term which is lambda bar D lambda bar H, plus a term D theta. So this is the pole here. Now you need to cancel that pole. So the cancellation can actually come if I add these free fermions here, where the pole of R with S is going to give me a term lambda bar d lambda bar h. So when I compute g minus with g minus, I'll get a contribution of this with itself, which is canceled by the contribution of this with this. Now, to get this piece, it's a little bit more work, but that piece is essentially responsible for giving this term here. And now you have to keep going and check, okay, so that this with this is going to give you, well, okay, so there are obviously many other terms that you have to consider. Adding this to G plus is necessary because, so using this definition here, what you find is that Q, so this is what I call Q. So Q with H is not zero, but it gives you something like lambda B. So that's this here. So the lambda B, the lambda can either contract with the lambda bar, that gives you one, and that just reproduces the contraction of this with this. Or you could get lambda contracting with R, but that's zero because of this constraint. So what you find is that this term with this term gives you T. This term with this term cancels this with this. And again, this with this cancels this with this, etc. So I'm sure there's a nicer way to understand this, but up to now it was just generated by just computing these commutators. So the structure is somehow forced on you by this, as he called, descent relation. But I don't have a nicer way to say it. I don't know. I'm sorry, I can't say more. Okay. Now, in computing the cohomology of just G+, if W bar was unrelated to lambda, then the cohomology of this would just be the cohomology of this in the smaller Hilbert space, just using the usual non-minimal coupling. But things are not so simple because lambda bar and lambda are related. So in fact, the cohomology of G plus by itself is zero. It's trivial. So let me explain that. So whenever you have an object whose commutator with the BST operator is 1, then the cohomology is trivial. So in this case, this anti-commutator is 1 just because it commutes with this. Oh, sorry. With this one. So G plus, when acting on theta, gives you lambda, which because of this constraint just gives you 1. And commuting with this just gives you R theta because the lambda bar with the W bar gives you a theta. So what you find is that the commutator of G plus with this object here, it looks strange, but you can of course expand this because it is something nilpotent. So this is just equal to lambda bar theta 1 minus R theta plus R theta. So Q with this object is equal to 1. Q, when I say Q now, I really mean the integral of G plus. So this means that the cohomology of this object is trivial. So the argument is simple. If if I have an object which satisfies Q1, it is 1, so let me call this object C, then it's easy to show that V is Q of XV. So if V is annihilated by Q, then this is just equal to Q of XV. V is equal to V. So any object which is annihilated by Q can be written as Q of something. Okay, so this is naively bad, but when one works in the RNS formalism in the large Hilbert space, the BRST operator also has that property. So if one thinks of Q in RNS, if one is allowed to work in the large Hilbert space, then there's an object to construct which has that same property. So this, if you like, is the picture raised version of a picture lowered version of the Xi ghost. So as is well known in these n equals 4 topological strings, or in this C hat equals 2 n equals 2, you have to define your cohomology not just with respect to Q, but also with respect to this object which restricts you in the small Hilbert space, so which was called eta in this, in the RNS form. So one's going to do something similar here. Unfortunately, because I don't have a good way to write these n equals 4 operators, I'm not going to say explicitly what that is. But at least it's clear that this kind of object is going to appear in scattering amplitudes in the large Hilbert space. Okay, so let me tell you how the tree amplitude description works. Okay, so the idea is not so complicated. I just need more space. Okay, I'm going to give up on this. So for tree amplitudes, in the old prescription I had something like VVV, and now I want to think of these objects as now being somehow chiral objects in this language, because G plus of V is equal to 0, which means that because of using this Xi ghost, I can naively write this as G plus of Xi of omega, let's call it. So the correct way to define these correlators in n equals 2 formalism is to work in the large Hilbert space, where now I need a... I'm going to again use these double brackets, but it doesn't mean what I meant, but how I used it before. So it's going to be... the idea is that you work in a large Hilbert space where you introduce an additional Xi. And this is going to give me the scattering amplitude. So if this is in the large, this is a small Hilbert space. This is large. Or if you like, you peel one of the G tilde pluses. Oh, sorry, this should have been a V. You pull one of the G tilde pluses off of a V. So that's how you go from the small Hilbert space to the large Hilbert space. So this would have ghost number 3, whereas this would have ghost number 2. And now I'm going to claim that in this large Hilbert space, the amplitude prescription is very natural. So using this Xi ghost. Okay, so maybe that's the last thing I'll do. So, suppose we try to compute this object, just a three-point amplitude scattering using the Xi ghost. But now this integration is going to be an integration over all the fields. So it involves an integration over the lambdas and lambda bars, which is now completely straightforward because this is just an integration over the SO10 over SU5 coset space. Then you have an integration over the thetas and an integration over the r's. And okay, now you just want to have Now you have this object here, this C. And okay, and that's it. Now these R's, because they are constrained, the natural way to integrate over them is to, if you want, you can just impose the constraint by, so the constraints were that lambda R equals lambda bar gamma R equals zero. It's just to integrate over all 16 R's, but with, since fermion imposing a constraint, this is just the delta function of the constraint, you just integrate over all 16. So you ignore the constraint. In the integration, but then you put in this delta function. So the way to impose these is just by putting in lambda r. These might look more tricky, but the way to impose it is just you have so this object here is actually imposes that lambda bar gamma r equals zero. So you can see it's fifth order in the r's and it's cubic in the lambda bars. It's precisely, if you like, the conjugate of what I wrote before for the lambdas and the thetas. So this object just imposes that all five independent components of this are zero. Okay, then you have the lambda a. Okay, now the claim is that this is going to give me the right prescription. So
the lambda and the lambda bar is still constrained integration.
Yeah, this integration here is just over the SO10 over SU5 coset. So lambda, so that's, it's straightforward to do. It's just
so it's some geometric, just the geometric measurement.
Yeah. So you can probably do it by hand just by, well, okay, yes, it is just that. Okay, so just counting, you can easily count, if I did the counting right, how what's going to happen. So it's clear you need an equal number of lambdas and lambda bars to get something non-vanishing. So here I have a lambda bar here, I have three lambda bars here, and I also have my four lambdas here. Then you need all 16 thetas, all 16 r's. So here I get six r's coming from here, so I need 10 to come from this denominator. So just the top term here contributes. And that gives you 10 thetas. Contract to, then you have one more theta coming from here, and then the other five thetas come from these A's. So this is the way to understand this tree amplitude prescription from this n equals 2 language. So you have to introduce these non-minimal fields and this Xi ghost, or if you like, this Xi field, which is the inverse to the G plus, and that allows you to write, to understand the tree amplitudes in a simple way. So for loops, it's slightly more complicated, and I don't have a nice way to do it, just because I now need to do integrations over the zero modes for the conjugates. So you see, in this prescription, I never had to introduce picture-lowering operators. That's essentially because the zero modes for the lambdas were all taken account just by doing this coset integration. But for the conjugates, I will still have their zero modes, and I don't... Well, I don't have a nice geometrical way to understand how to do the integration over the conjugates to the lambdas. So it's clear that this kind of structure for the B goes, the one I just erased, I guess. So the G minus had all of these BHKL fields sitting in them. And I've done the zero mode counting. It looks like the zero mode counting is going to work. But to get the more explicit equivalence with with the description I did before, when it needs more work.
But this prescription here doesn't need any of all those complicated things, actually.
Right, at least for tree amplitudes, it doesn't. So for loop amplitudes, I will need something which restricts the zero modes for the Ws. Can I have 5 minutes soon? Okay, so the last thing I wanted to say is maybe how to show an equivalence of this with the RNS. So that was one of the main motivations for understanding this N equals 2. So I'll just say something quickly, which it's almost all I can say anyways. But the fact that you have this SO10 over SU5, if you think of this as some kind of harmonic, super harmonic space, this is precisely the kind of structure you need if you want to find an n equals 2 in the INS. So you have 10 psi's, and somehow this tells you how you want to split the psi's into psi's and psi bars. So one can say this a little bit more explicitly. If one has the 10 psi's, one can try to split them, use the lambdas and lambda bars to split them into a 5 and a 5 bar. So it's not difficult to do. I'll tell you what this gamma and gamma are. If I want, okay, I have to, the only way I know how to do this at the moment is to use the large, use the whole n equals 2 structure. So if I call the q n equals 2, so this would be the n equals 2 BRST operator that I could build out of these C hat n equals 2 matter generators. And now I've put in my n equals 2 ghosts. So the n equals 2 ghosts are U, gamma, gamma bar, and DC. Now the claim is that this is going to be related to the RNS BRST operator. It's going to be this QRNS plus some topological section. And the way to go from here to here is you have to write the RNS matter fields in terms of these pure spinner matter fields. So the natural thing to do is to write psi in terms of the pure spinner thetas. So you write the RNS fermions in terms of the pure spinner fermions. And this is some kind of twisting. So gamma is the usual RNS ghost. This implies that gamma squared is going to be equal to gamma. So the RNS ghost, the square, is somehow related to the n equals 2 ghosts. So it's like the square root of the product of the n equals 2 ghosts. And now if you use this map, you do find this kind of structure. Okay, so Q top is going to be something like lambda p hat plus I'm not sure it's worth writing this down, but okay, there's also some sector coming from the U1 ghosts. So the idea is that using this description of the pure spinner formalism, where you have a BRST operator of the usual type, you can try to find the field redefinition which takes you to the RNS BRST operator. Okay, so I apologize for taking so long, but I'll...
Usually when we have some fields living in some non-trivial manifold, we have non-trivial sigma models and we deal with it. And there's no easy way of, we don't start with the free field and impose the constraints on the OPs. How are you dealing with this? I'm not understanding some of the logic.
Okay, so suppose I have... So let me just work with that constraint. Sure. Okay, so suppose I want to compute OPEs in which I only have objects. So, of course, the lambdas and lambda bars, this constraint doesn't do anything. If I have an action of the type lambda d bar w, so suppose I have an action of this type, in which the lambdas and w's are conjugates, but lambda has no pole with lambda bar. But this constraint will affect the OPs of w with lambda. So, for example, if I try to...
That constraint will be inconsistent with the OPs of W and lambda.
Will be inconsistent, is that?
I think so.
Yeah, so...
Lambda and bar is a C number, but W has some singularity.
Okay, so any operator which has a pole with lambda, lambda bar... So this object is not a well-defined object in the presence of this constraint, because if I compute this OPE, naively it would give you something which is non-zero. But suppose I only work with operators which don't have poles with this. So these operators are operators which are invariant under those gauge transformations I meant. So for example, suppose instead of computing... what operators are allowed? So for example, Lorentz generators. This Lorentz generator would commute with this. So I can compute OPEs of at least at the... not classical level, but I mean it... Poisson bracket level, I can compute OPEs of these objects. Now, it's true, to compute at the quantum level and worry about double poles, the only way that's consistent to do it is to, that I know, is to solve this constraint in terms of these free fields which don't transform Lorentz covariantly. So that you can do. I don't know if that...
No, but if I recall correctly, once you solve it, you got some non-linear actions. And so again, you push the problem to the action. Action would be...
It wasn't a non-linear action. So suppose... let me go to this. So I can write lambda in terms of gamma and u and...
Yeah, the second piece was non-linear. The third piece.
Yeah, but the w... So you have a gauge invariance for w... And you can choose the conjugate to this to be zero. So it gives you... So let's say the conjugate to this...
So you think you can solve the constraints of the action to the quadratic?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So the action is just the type...
Okay. So that's the state. That's the reason you expect there to be a free theory formulas. Because solving the constraints still does not make the action interactive.
Yes.
But that's a feature because you have the first order action.
Yes.
So if you had a second order action, you couldn't do that.
That's right.
Any other questions? Okay, it's not.